Christopher Callicott is the managing director at Trammell Venture Partners, the first Bitcoin native VC fund. We spoke in September about TVP's business, the investing frameworks they use, why they're so excited about things like AI and the Lightning Network, and much more. Before we get into today's show, just a quick shout out to today's sponsors. Today's show is sponsored by Stackwork. Stackwork is a lightning-powered transcription tool that takes the best of AI and humans to create better, faster, less expensive transcripts. Today's show is also sponsored by CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth was created to get rid of the headaches of health insurance and give you a better solution for your healthcare needs. Today's show is also sponsored by Vida, the free AI phone screener that stops unwanted spam by setting a price for your time. If you pick up your phone right now and call 606-SATS-123 or 606-728-7123, you'll get a link to download Vida and 2100 sats. Christopher, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to talk about TVP and the work you're doing funding Bitcoin companies. We had a chance to chat, I guess it was 4 months ago, maybe in Austin. Really got to know you and some of your colleagues, and I'm excited to hear more about TVP, but I want to start with your background. I want to learn more about what you were doing prior to Bitcoin.
That's great. Thanks for having me, Kevin. Good to connect with you here on your show. Our background, you know, we're a little bit different than some venture capital firms in that neither myself nor my partner, Dustin, we didn't come out of an asset management background. We didn't come from a bigger firm. A lot of times, you know, merging managers will be a spin out and they spent some time at a bigger firm. We're actually both career technologists. I did a lot in tech, from taking hardware products to market. I did some significant senior administration for regional internet service providers before there was a lot of industry consolidation, small business things like consultancy around search, and just a wide variety of things in tech, a generalist in the truest sense. And while I was pretty broad, Dustin was very, very deep in the security industry. So before there was really a cybersecurity industry per se, he was doing things like finding unknown vulnerabilities in systems and then building signatures for things like intrusion prevention on enterprise grade networks. So everything you ever saw in a movie about a hacker, he was really down in the weeds doing primary research, presenting at conferences. And so we come from this decidedly tech background, and just happened to find our way. Our path, life path took us to Bitcoin, and we saw a big opportunity. And that's the background.
So did you know each other prior to getting into Bitcoin? Was this like you guys were friendly and knew each other in the industry?
It's a great question. And the answer is yes. In fact, risking dating ourselves a little bit, we've been friends since October 98. So we go way on back at this point. We kind of come up through the earlier years of the web and had a lot of experience. And I think that really informs what we do today. We've seen lots of, fight for competition with like clear category winners all the way back to before the browser wars period of the early web. And so seeing, you know, new ideas, destruction, usually one or two incumbents left standing and developed this kind of longitudinal experience of watching that pattern over and over again. So that really informs what we do day to day now.
Right. So when did you two decide, okay, we know each other, we've been in tech for a while, here's this cool thing called Bitcoin, it's time to start a Bitcoin fund or a fund for Bitcoin companies. When did that come about?
I think the best way to answer that question is to go ahead and just give you a bit of our broader background to our story, and it becomes pretty clear. So with that kind of tech background, doing a lot of things, and I would add that Dustin and I both have two areas of similarity that was broader from our bigger group of technologist friends around Texas, two ways. First, we're both lifelong privacy and security advocates. We're also sort of little L libertarian people, very interested in things like Austrian economics, the study of boom bust cycles. We had seen attempts at digital currencies come and go. And in the earlier years of the web, it just sort of made intuitive sense to people like myself, Dustin, and others that it makes sense that there would arrive some way to express value and transfer value that's native to the internet itself, native to the web. So fast forward about 11 years into our friendship, because of Dustin's background as a security researcher, he had been on the cryptography mailing list for probably 7, 8, maybe 9 years at that point. Now he wasn't a cryptographer per se. He doesn't have, you know, advanced degrees in math and that sort of thing, but he touched on hashing all the time. And he was very generally interested in puzzles, cryptology, and that sort of thing. And so Halloween 2008, when Satoshi published the white paper, you know, he had already been around for a while and he was just very curious. Being a hacker, his normal wiring and inclination is to just try stuff, you know, tinker. And so he did. And, you know, fast forward just a couple of months and Satoshi releases the first version of the software. At the time, you know, Bitcoin was very monolithic. There was, of course, the wallet. There was a consensus verification and a miner all in, you know, one piece of software that operated in the computer, just like anything else. And there's one other nuance here that kind of made this help that make sense. There were a couple of projects, you know, back to the end of the 90s, early 2000s, that attempted to do something that was heavily computational. One was SETI at Home, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They gather like massive amounts of X-ray and other kind of radio telescope data, but it's hard to process it. So they would use CPU cycles in a distributed compute kind of sense to try to find signal and all that background noise from their radio telescopes. And another one that was very a different application, but the same pattern where you're using, you know, your screensaver comes on and now your computer's doing some processing in the background, one called Folding at Home. In the life sciences realm, you know, chronic diseases of the mind, like Alzheimer's, the commonality there is the way that proteins in our matter, in our gray matter and other parts of our body, they have a normal shape and they fold. When those get obscure, things like a mad cow disease, that prion caused an unusual folding pattern. And so it's a heavy computational problem. So we had seen that. So back to Bitcoin, we had already seen this pattern where you're using CPU cycles to do some decentralized compute problem. And so he installed Bitcoin. He thought it was really cool. There were, you know, some early interactions with him and Satoshi. He found a couple of bugs along the way early on, and Satoshi kind of famously sent him some Bitcoin. So, you know, he mined a bunch of early blocks. So that's the background. Back to your kind of bigger question, it wasn't sort of, hey, Bitcoin's cool, let's start a fund. You know, we had this organic process, and Dustin in the early years was kind of like the Johnny Appleseed of Bitcoin. You know, he gave, I mean, it's probably a shockingly large number, monetary amount of what he's given away to just get people to experiment with it and kind of evangelize the idea of Bitcoin in the early years. You know, me and a bunch of our friends around Texas, we certainly knew about Bitcoin early on because of Dustin. And so fast forward just a few more years, back to your question about how we come to do what we're doing, we had something that's pretty unusual because Dustin did two things. First, he was very technical. He understood, at a time no one used the word blockchain. Maybe if they had heard of Bitcoin, it might have been sort of in a nefarious dark web sense. So there was a lot of uncertainty around it. They would reach out to him because he got the technology. And more importantly, from an investment standpoint for founders, they knew he was early enough that he, by definition, had to be an accredited investor and therefore a target for their early projects. And so, he would have people reach out. He wouldn't have said deal flow because, like I said, we didn't come from asset management, but he had an organic deal flow, they'd reach out, hey, Dustin, take a look at this. I'm working on this project. And so back in 2014 and again in 2015, a company called Payward Inc., which is the company that owns all of the Kraken brands, Jesse reached out and we had some conversations. That was when I was finishing up B school in 2014 and then moved back to Texas after 11 years away to join Dustin. And we did a Well, I'd say it this way. There was a time when even a company that at the time was called the Kraken Bitcoin Exchange, clearly that's evolved a little bit. But, you know, there wasn't all this, you know, billions, tens of billions of dollars and, you know, crypto venture money sloshing around. So they had a FEMOT date. And so there was a Series A bridge. We participated and I joined the board as an observer at that time in 2015. And that gave us, we were investing with our own capital on our balance sheet. TVP was born in 2016. We started kind of laying the groundwork to who are these mysterious investors, these LPs and that sort of thing. And we did a deal with our own capital, warehoused it for the fund. And our first fund, TVP1, was a 2019 vintage. Then we started doing some investments out of that fund, Unchained Capital's in that fund, and a couple of applied AI companies, mostly because at that time, there wasn't sufficient deal flow to give rise to a dedicated mandate. But in December 2019, someone said, "Hey, Christopher, why have you and Dustin never done a dedicated Bitcoin investment strategy?" I said, "Well, what I just mentioned here, that there wasn't sufficient deal flow, but you know, Lightning is, you know, getting some early traction. It's small, but I really feel like it's going to grow. And we're seeing more things come across our desk." And so we started doing the work. Then COVID happened. Anyway, fast forward to January 2021, we put together the first close of TVP Bitcoin Venture Fund 1, which we gave it a new Roman numeral 1, even though it was our second fund, just to signal to the market that we're here to stay. Bitcoin's always been our North Star. And so that's the background and how we come to this circuitous path to get to where we are today.
Very cool. I'd love to dive into that first experience funding Kraken. And I'd love to just hear your perspective, because this was well before I even knew what Bitcoin was. You've now been through so many cycles here, and you've seen the ecosystem evolve, the startup landscape evolve, you've seen Bitcoin evolve. I'd love to hear just like, what was the sentiment like in 2014 when Kraken came to you and said, "Hey, we're looking for some funding." Were there many other companies that you could kind of look to and go, "Okay, this company, there's precedent for this being successful, or there's a potential for this to earn a lot of money"? Or did you think this is still kind of like some really experimental business? We have no idea if this is going to take off. Would just love to hear your assessment of Kraken at that time.
So, you know, I would say we're a little bit of an unusual group for that question, in the sense that we had for so many years at that point already had this view that, look, with network effects, people would always have the question, "Well, what if there's some bug that we still don't know about?" And these kinds of things. But we felt like, barring those kinds of existential threats, and, you know, Dustin being a security person, you know, had done his own homework there. You know, we felt like the traction was such that Bitcoin likely had escape velocity versus any other would-be competitor. And at the time, the competitors, so-called, were largely forks of Bitcoin's blockchain and making a couple of changes. And we just didn't feel like those are ever going to meaningfully compete with Bitcoin. And so with that as a market view, and that's decidedly a view, right? So with an opportunity like Kraken, it's kind of like, you don't want to own an asset like this. If it has money properties, if it's going to have real staying power, you really don't want to own an asset that is not highly liquid. Liquidity service provisioning is the first and foremost obvious thing for us, at least in our minds, to build. And at the time, you know, there were a couple of companies, you know, out there trying. We had, you know, seen, massive failures because they're big honeypots operated by people that didn't know what they were doing. Coinbase was out there around that same time. For Jesse Powell and Ton and the rest of the Kraken Bitcoin Exchange team, one of the things that was a clincher in particular around diligence is they had completed a significant penetration test on their systems. They seemed like they were always oriented to security as a first principle. And honestly, you know, in the mental models, things that we care about a lot around, you know, privacy and as well as security, kind of libertarian like principles and views of the world. And really, that was kind of the spirit of the early days of the internet. It was a little like the Wild West, but generally a pretty safe place for most people. It was fun. It was exciting. We had a lot of alignment on a lot of different levels, but with that always being oriented towards security as a posture and part of the what they were trying to create in their culture at Kraken, it just made a lot of sense to us that while, you know, the Mt. Goxes of the world might fail and others like them, that should give them a chance to survive and develop what in hindsight will look like survivorship bias as others fail. And that sort of orientation towards security kind of plays out in a number of different ways. We, you know, things like several years later, when Joe and Drew started building Unchained Capital, they certainly had a view that aligned with ours that, you know, you can go and kind of roll your own security model, but then you've got to, you take on a huge burden versus the protocol itself that has some of the sharpest minds in the world looking at it, you know, in an open source way all the time. And so they took an open source approach as well and leaned into multi-party multi-sig that was native to Bitcoin's protocol itself. And so those kinds of opportunities give companies that are early stage and going to naturally struggle a chance to survive when others might have an existential threat that just shows up unexpectedly and results in the loss of customers' funds. So anyway, that was a clincher for us with Kraken in those early days and some of the elements that were floating around our minds and when those investments were made.
And did you see the potential for Kraken to grow into the business it is today back then? I mean, obviously it's, you know, now looking back, you can kind of, you may be biased here, but I would love to just hear your, the like risk tolerance you had then, the thinking about what is the addressable market here if this succeeds. Did you at the time think of Bitcoin as this could become the money of the world, or did it still not kind of click for you and back in 2014 that this opportunity was that big?
Yeah, you know, I would think of it in terms of sort of immediately attainable market, and these kinds of market structures and just knowing from other patterns that we see in, you know, public equities markets and et cetera, those are businesses that are given toward monopoly. You know, liquidity is a phenomenon. Liquidity tends to beget more liquidity. And you want a long enough runway. The security factor buys you that orientation buys you a long enough runway to get a little lucky at key moments. We knew that at the time the market was ultimately pretty small, but you know, we had a strong view about Bitcoin in particular, and we didn't feel like it was going to always be strong, small as long as we continued to see some adoption. At that point, you know, Bitcoin was already, you know, 5 years old or over 5 years old. Actually, it was approaching the time of the late 2014 investment. It would have been almost 6 years old. And so, you know, we had some patterns and we saw some failures that resonated with us. We kind of understood why. And, you know, we felt like ultimately it would be big enough. Simple trading is it's a bit monodimensional. It's very important, but the on-ramp function is far more important for continued adoption. And so, a clear path that will resonate with retail people so that they can actually make their first purchases and that sort of thing were really important. So we felt like, and this, there continues to be a lot of truth here, that with the multi-decadal adoption curve of something like Bitcoin, if we're right about what we think, you know, to your question about, you know, you think this is money, and we really felt like this had a chance to be the internet's monetary function, you know, along with other protocols like, you know, HTTPD and others, then the companies that help realize that and are strongly in the mix and moving the needle will naturally benefit from that wave of adoption. One of the things that, Dustin probably has, you know, kind of very different perceptions and then some overlap. But one of the things that I saw during kind of my initial research, just right after, you know, during and right after B school, about the venture capital industry, you know, kind of like, why does this exist? You know, how does success work in venture? You know, all these kinds of fundamental, like foundational questions about venture capital as an asset. I stumbled upon a lot of, you know, really interesting things about some of the most storied firms, and did a lot of really just sort of teardowns of firms that are continuously having success long term, and trying to find the commonalities and build up a mental model before we ever started writing checks based on other people's money. And, you know, and out of that, I saw something that really still resonates with me. In fact, at TabConf recently, I shared this anecdote. I'll share it again now. Don Valentine was one of the founders of Sequoia Capital. Sequoia is, you know, if you're not familiar with Sequoia, it's, you know, one of the storied venture capital firms. Sequoia led YouTube's, you know, seed series A round, series B, just as one example out of literally hundreds of big success of startups that have gone public, et cetera. Don Valentine used to like to make a quote when he was talking about startups and how to succeed, you know, in venture, and how to succeed in venture, investing in startups. He said, give me a B team in an A market. And believe me when I say, it's not because Sequoia is out looking for B teams. They're looking for absolute rock stars. What he means, though, is there are certain aspects, almost like a tidal force in markets that are inevitable, that are happening, and that will drive success in such a way that oftentimes will allow founders that are maybe their first time to found a company to make a few mistakes and course correct because of the tidal force moving this wave directionally towards adoption. You know, I think I look at Bitcoin as the mother of all waves. We've seen disruption throughout so many different industries, like almost all of them. We've not seen a disruption in the way that we think about money, you know, state controlled, centralized, issued by decree, something that even adversarial nations can use, you know, something similar. It shouldn't be a tool for oppression and these kinds of ideas that we care a lot about philosophically. We think that Bitcoin is that, full stop. And we felt that way for a long time. And we're starting to really see that get some, you know, second order effects and acceleration through things like Lightning and others, as, you know, some of our earlier investments are achieving some escape velocity. Kraken being a great example of that from our, some of our earliest investments. But it's actually a really exciting time. And so that market piece is what we just kind of, it's really a key part of our mental model at TVP in terms of what are the effects here that will give founders a chance to succeed longitudinally. And I think that these founders that are building these companies are going to see some fantastic success, and also other people that are investing in the space.
I really like that analogy. And that point about markets, is, I think, is really, really informative. Now, when I think about that, though, I think about what is an A market? And I think of in the 90s, the A market may have been just the internet. And you see Google and you see Amazon come out of that kind of 90s cohort. Early 2000s, maybe it's the A market is social. And you see Facebook and you see YouTube and you see Twitter all kind of come out of that cohort. How long is the window here for Bitcoin to be that A market where it's okay if founders make mistakes? It's not at that big of a deal because there is this big tidal wave of adoption. Like, I don't think these things last forever, right? The market kind of opportunity and window for someone to take advantage of an underappreciated asset or market, I don't know how long you think that is, but I imagine it's not forever. So where are we in that kind of opening or that window for Bitcoin? We started in 2009. Companies didn't start to pick up steam really until a few years after that. But now we're almost 15 years into Bitcoin as a as a protocol, you know, how much longer do we have for, you know, B founders or folks who may come into the space and just not, maybe it's their first time or they're not experienced as founders previously. How long do they have to kind of take advantage of this tailwind before the market matures and kind of stabilizes?
Great question. Perhaps unsurprisingly for you and your listeners and viewers, we have a very patient capital approach to our investing style. You know, our portfolio construction is decidedly concentrated. We do, you know, thesis market based decisions with what we think is the right team and take some pretty big swings on those teams and taking a very patient approach to deployment. You know, and where we are now when we're recording this, you know, we're about 6 weeks out from Bitcoin's white paper's 15th birthday, you know, and we know that it's like a almost a tired refrain at this point. We're early with Bitcoin. And so I actually think that some of those earlier internet adoption waves were in some regards kind of low hanging fruit. You know, to be able to purchase something online made a lot of sense. It took, I mean, I remember spending most of the 90s before this got to be a bit more streamlined. And even then it was high risk. We had entrenched incumbent and regulatory regimes that were actually an impediment in that early wave. Maybe listeners might not even have been old enough to track this, but I remember there were multiple years of fighting about encryption, strong encryption itself in a browser, because there were export controls in the United States from best in class encryption. This, you know, there were Supreme Court rulings around this. If we hadn't gotten strong encryption in a browser in place, e-commerce, you know, at the end of the 90s and early 2000s, you mentioned Amazon, could not have happened. And this, you know, this, all of the regulatory pieces, all of the incumbents that want to fight their own disintermediation, those kind of effects take place over significant time frames. I think it's easy to feel like, gosh, we've got to be nearly there, and then we're sort of done. I think it's extremely early days. I think another way to tackle this question is to think about just the basic properties of money. There's been a lot written over the years and about the different definitions of money, from, you know, stores of value and media of exchange down to unit of account. And I think that's probably an interesting just kind of gut check on where we are. We're just now seeing the opportunity for really at any kind of consumer scale payments technology through Lightning Network. And we've got a lot of work to do with Lightning itself, which is exciting, because as a gut check, you know, that's got to be absolutely the most seamless. Don't even think about it in terms of like what technology you're using. It just always works to the degree that, you know, we think about Apple Pay working or something along those lines. And so we're going to get there for sure. And it's probably not going to take that long of a time. But if you think about, if you go to the industries that have resisted disruption from technology, they're really, really big ones. They tend to have regulatory moats, you know, heavily regulated. They tend to be, you know, very high CapEx. And one thing that I think is really an orthogonal into disruption in these industries that we see currently, even playing out in the very, very early days in our portfolio, one of the commonalities about the disruption effects of money as it applies to businesses is the amount of risk due to trying to make payments happen on the legacy rails and what that means for companies that want to actually try to innovate. There's a generalized problem that we're already seeing in our current portfolio for very big industries. Think telecommunications, think energy itself. If you're a telecommunications company, to sort of tap on that for a minute, you have a very, very expensive, high CapEx network. And if you have some scrappy young company that they think they have a great idea, but they need access to your network in order to try something and attempt to innovate, that would ultimately be attractive for an acquisition for the big telecom company, this big behemoth that that sees something that gets validation. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to innovate in that industry. And the primary reason is that you have to open up your very, very expensive network to this very small company that's probably not well capitalized. And in just a short month or two, they could rack up literally tens of millions of dollars in bills that they would either be unable to pay, the company might shut down, there's no recourse. And so it's incredibly difficult to innovate with that being the case. Energy markets, very similar. If you're an energy asset producer and someone wants to, hey, let's try this great idea that we've got, you very quickly, a power purchase agreements that take some time to negotiate. They're usually for long term, you know, 5, 10 or more years. To try and to innovate over a shorter time scale, whenever in both of those cases, energy and telecommunications, you have a settlement period of maybe, you know, at least 30, but usually 60 or 90 days. In that time, the company could be out of business. So you're taking a book of risk of literally tens of millions of dollars for some indeterminate period of time just to open up the opportunity for innovation. That's untenable. And so it doesn't happen. It's rare that there's a real opportunity to do something disruptive and innovative in those two industries. But that generalized risk problem is something that, as it turns out, what if you had an internet native money that moved globally nearly instantaneously at extremely low cost? And once you got that money, it was fully final and in your hands. And by the way, you could receive it in a stream of sats, in small increments over that period of time. Suddenly a risk book that's, you know, massive gets collapsed and the opportunity for innovation opens up. And so, now that said, when you're talking about communications industries, when you're talking about energy industries, you know, the earliest validation in a small, you know, serviceable or attainable market within that, you know, many trillions of market size, it'll take a while for that to be validated, other people to take some additional risk, some early acquisition and application at scale. I think that's actually going to play out over a significant period of time. And so to your question, I think for a lot of these market structural reasons, when you're talking about the disruption that money does, it might actually, you know, take a significant period of time. And the good news is there will probably be multiple waves of, you know, growth, traction, adoption, acquisition, application, a new proposed business model. And so multiple waves until, you know, we get to a long-term state where lightning or something like it is native to the way that you do something like pricing energy, for example, which is a market view we've had for a long time, but it's going to take a long time to get there.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So to touch on that Don Valentine quote once more, you said the quote was, give me a B team and an A market. Well, I know you're not looking for B teams. And I know we have a lot of A founders and A teams in the Bitcoin and Lightning ecosystem. I want to hear more about how you assess and identify the A founders. How do you find, you know, are there any traits or common themes that you look for in assessing whether someone has that ability to be that A founder and really take their product to the masses?
Yeah, I think as early as we sometimes invest in, especially with, you know, we're going a little earlier in our second fund, the first Bitcoin venture fund than we did in our first fund, because it's a very high specificity mandate, right? And so that means you're necessarily starting with two key components. I mentioned, you know, we invest from a place of thesis and, you know, strong feelings about, you know, we have kind of in our hip pocket some ideas about things that definitely need to be built and the way things will go. Ideally, you're kind of taking a spearfishing approach to the right founders to build that. And to your question, to whatever that particular case might be. And so to your question, you know, ideally, we're looking for someone that has a wealth of experience, domain knowledge, domain expertise about the market that they're playing in. I know you're involved to some degree with Vita. You know, I think Lyle Pratt's a great example. Most of his entire career has been around telecommunications, the communications industry. And here's a great example of, you know, a multi-exit founder who has, you know, deep expertise in communications and also happens to see the Lightning Network itself as this massive and growing market opportunity, that the network itself looks like a communications network that happens to be payments native. And so that's a great example of how we think about founders. But really, it's, you know, it boils down to, you know, experience, domain knowledge that lends itself to kind of that founder light bulb moment. They say, there's a problem here. This is the first thing I've ever seen that actually sees this one generalized problem that we've always struggled with, you know, previously. And so, and that's like that's the catalyst to them getting increasing momentum on what they're building. And those are the kinds of A founders that we love to partner with. So.
I hope you're enjoying the show so far. Just a quick message from our sponsor, Stackwork. Stackwork is a lightning powered platform for generating high quality transcripts of all your audio or video content. They combine AI engines and hundreds of human workers all over the world who are paid over the Lightning Network to assemble these transcripts. And that's what lets Stackwork create better, faster, and less expensive transcripts. To see the results for yourself, you can check out my personal website where I host transcripts for all my podcast episodes. If you want to learn more about Stackwork, visit stackwork.com. That is STAKwork.com. Do you think there's something to the fact that these founders that you're looking for are building on Bitcoin? Do you think there's something about Bitcoin that makes that kind of attracts these A founders that are willing to, you know, take time and build a business for the long run, rather than founders in another industry or maybe in the broader crypto space, where there may be a shorter path to an exit or more of an incentive to quickly show traction if there's a liquid token or something like that. I just think about, you know, the types of people that Bitcoin attracts, and I wonder if that is a meaningful, you know, it leads to a meaningful improvement in the quality of founders that we see in the ecosystem. Is that true in your view?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think that one of the mechanisms that makes a founder sort of sold out on the Bitcoin Lightning stack being a key solve for whatever it is that they're attacking in terms of a problem, that might be pretty similar to the way that other people just get sold out on Bitcoin in terms of their own usage, their own the reasons that they're saving in Bitcoin, and it solves a problem for them, and so the technology is the unlock, and but the increasing value and adoption is kind of the wave, and it's got to be someone that's capable of seeing something that other people are not. Clearly, there are a lot of very smart people that are not focused on Bitcoin yet, but then again, if you look at someone like Jack Dorsey, who's, you know, multi-time, you know, multi-exit founder, he first mentioned Bitcoin, I think it was when Bitcoin was around $11, and then kind of always had that around, and probably was thinking about, at the right time, it might make sense for me to do something more significant with that. And so that probably got accreted to, you know, like one additional facet in his mental model that at the right time, you know, it's like, okay, this is actually ready to solve this bigger problem that he's been working toward, you know, around, you know, point of sale with Block, Square, or something along those lines. So I don't know if there's something unique to the wiring. We actually, part of why we're doing what we're doing now and looking to continue building TVP is, you know, I just really firmly believe that there is a massive latent demand to build on the money once these founders and entrepreneurs that maybe they've been tinkering, you know, somewhere else because they didn't recognize that Bitcoin is either currently capable or very near term going to be capable of doing something that they need to unlock what they, I think lot of people are probably thinking about Ethereum and Solana and some of these other places because they've listened to a lot of narrative that's been built around, well, you just can't do that on Bitcoin and, you know, it's hard to build. And that might've been true for some interesting reasons a few years ago, but it's all the time at an accelerating pace, not true any longer. And so I think that's exciting. And we're going to see lots of people come back to first principles and then kind of realize, oh, that was, it wasn't just cool tech. There's this beautiful philosophical underpinning to that's just, you know, neatly expressed in a technology that we can use day to day. So it's maybe they didn't get that at first blush.
Yeah. Now you wrote a research report, you and the TVP team, on, I believe, the growth of Bitcoin startups over the last few years. You looked at 2021, 2022. I'd love to hear more about your findings there. And then thinking about 2023, are you seeing an acceleration in the number of new startup ideas, the number of founders, the money that is kind of flowing into the Bitcoin startup ecosystem?
Yeah, as you mentioned the research. Thanks for mentioning that. We think that it's really important at this. What I think is, you know, we're just ahead of an inflection point where acceleration really does start to pick up in that regard. And it's already growing, but a real acceleration as founders start to think about first principles and, you know, kind of have their, of course, it's been Bitcoin all along. Anyone should have been able to see that. It'll look obvious in hindsight to, you know, probably millions of people over the next, you know, 5 or 10 years. What they've heard since, you know, some of these, you know, we'll call them, you know, crypto VCs, actually, you know, a number of them came to us for seed capital and, you know, we just didn't really see the emphasis and that sort of thing back in the, you know, 2016, 2017, 2018 timeframe. They're kind of missing that philosophical piece and I hate to make a broad generalization. I think that seemed to be kind of in a recurring sense true sometimes. And they got very focused on, to your point earlier, about a token, which I don't think actually brings much in terms of validation, but it gives exit liquidity for investors, which, you know, internal rates of return, that's a function of time. And so it looks like they've got this, you know, insanely high IRR, when in fact, the problem that they're working to solve might be fully unsolved. And people are thinking about going on to some new, you know, speculation. It's not really an investment while someone's trying to build a company still, you know, in the early days. It takes a long time to build a company that is going to last the test of time. You know, it might look like to retail investors on Wall Street that they've not heard of Twilio until the last couple of years, but, you know, that was a company that was built over a long period of time, right? So a little bit of a digression, but I would say that all of that first wave of, you know, crypto VCs, they got focused on that short-term liquidity, the tokens, and then, okay, well, it's not scaling and the gas fees are high. What can we build now? And it's maybe we can find a layer two way to solve it. They've kind of gotten down in the weeds, but what they continuously repeated to the institutional investors that did get off zero and deploy capital, they repeated over and over and over again, the innovation's not happening on Bitcoin. One of the reasons why we developed that research, we felt like first, you know, with our longitudinal experience and, you know, sort of, you know, broad market view, we were able to instrument the universe of investable Bitcoin companies for a long time. And so that put us in a pretty unique position. That research needed to be out there to challenge assumptions that have been put into the market. Whenever, you know, sometimes when we talk with institutional investors, they'll say, well, you know, I invested in, you know, name your recognizable crypto VC. And, you know, they keep telling me nothing's happening on Bitcoin. Don't pay attention there. And I said, well, you know, I understand that they might be telling you that. And yet the data, if you can speak with data, that's always more powerful, right? And so between 2021 and 2022, obviously 2022 was a very down year. If you look at crypto spot markets, down bad, right? And crypto venture was about flat. It was up about 1% overall between those 2 years. Bitcoin native in that sea of billions of dollars invested in all this crypto stuff was up about 53% in our data in terms of, you know, companies and invested dollars as well. And by those two different views, and yet, you know, you I always think it's, I think about the St. Paul quote, be all things to all people. And so you want to speak to folks, you know, where they are. And so they're looking at all this crypto stuff, whether we like it as Bitcoiners that we fit into that crypto mental model. It's just, it's the way it is. So we might as well speak to them from a place that they'll recognize. And so if you added up every one of these tokens across all those different smart contract platforms and attempts to do things that ultimately I think will be built directly on the Bitcoin stack. If you added it all up, including all the price stable assets, which is arguably kind of cheating, but you added all that up, Bitcoin is nevertheless still market cap dominant. I think it was around, you know, 42 or 44% at the end of 2022. It's higher now, obviously. And so that market cap dominance, while I recognize as, you know, an investor, it's kind of a blunt instrument. It only goes so far. It is a metric that's spoken of a lot. And so that market cap dominance, we have one slide in this deck that puts that illustration there. Bitcoin, you know, kind of dominating all these other assets. The venture dollars that were allocated to Bitcoin native versus all this other crypto venture was only 1.31%, despite the fact that it was a breakout category in 2022. So these data can start to suggest to some of these allocators, hey, something's happening here. Do we have a Bitcoin focused manager? And the answer is going to almost invariably be no, we don't. You know, I think there was a time when people talked about diversification. Well, let's find all these different crypto managers. And we used to talk about as all the allocators in the world, they don't have spot exposure to Bitcoin. I said, you know, look, this is me back in like 2016 telling groups of investors, at some point, your perception of career risk to make that recommendation as an allocator on, you know, whatever your institutional LP is, if you don't do that, the bulk of the risk is having not allocated. And that time has long since passed. And if I were one of those folks with a big allocation to all these, you know, crypto venture managers, and there's this glaring hole to the Bitcoin and Lightning stack, I would be very concerned. And so the point of all this is to speak to folks from a place of data and just challenge some assumptions and say, look, this is something that's relevant. It's important. If you look at what's happening with just this, you know, deluge of ETF filings this year, these, you know, the BlackRocks of the world, the Invescos, the, you know, name your, you know, multi-trillion dollar asset manager, they're all talking about Bitcoin, you know, and so that's important. If you look at, you know, what Michael Saylor's done through MicroStrategy, Bitcoin, and you know, to a growing degree now, Lightning, Cash App, look, it'll look obvious in hindsight. They need to be thinking about how to allocate to the space. And so we challenge those assumptions. And anyway, it's available on the TVP website to download for free, and love to for people to just kind of keep it in mind and share it. And when you hear one of those people talking about the innovations not happening on Bitcoin, by all means, send them this deck, because there's a lot of work to do to reframe this narrative that's been built, that we could talk about why that might have been, but it's increasingly wrong for a lot of reasons.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So you mentioned, you know, market cap, even if you want to take that metric, you know, even if it doesn't perfectly encapsulate how the ecosystem's evolving, we're looking at 40%+, maybe 50. If we're looking at invested dollars into Bitcoin startups, we're looking at like 1%, which is a striking difference. Is it reasonable for this to, do you think that we will see a shift from that 1% up towards 40, 50 or more percent? Or how do you expect the Bitcoin startup ecosystem to evolve over time?
So that second question, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, I would say in fairness, and obviously it's important to think about the mental model and some of the questions you might get with some of these institutional allocators. Going back to what I think, you know, you and I both probably share strongly in terms of a market view, first principle, we believe that Bitcoin's already won the battle for the internet's monetary layer, full stop. We think that ultimately a lot of things, including, you know, public equities, bonds, whatever it might be, we think it all settles to Bitcoin in the end game. It could be a while to get there, and there's a lot to build clearly. In the early days, people like myself and Dustin, we would certainly be in this category of people that would say, look, go build some altcoin, do whatever you want to do. Just for the love of God, please don't break the internet's money. You know, you cannot take the Mark Zuckerberg move fast, break things approach when you're talking about something as critically important as the internet's monetary layer. And so, you know, we also said, look, we'll also be kind of paying attention. If you happen to stumble upon some massive validated market in due course, you know, that'll get reappropriated and brought home to build directly on Bitcoin if it makes sense. And so, you know, we've taken with Bitcoin Core, you know, we don't ever weigh in on, you know, proposed changes. We don't think that's our lane. We know what we have some edge at and what we're good at. So we don't weigh in there. But, you know, back in, you know, the 2015, 16, 17 timeframe, we certainly had our own quiet opinion about the approach to scaling Bitcoin, and a layered approach is how we, you know, how we quietly felt in the block size wars era. You know, we thought that was the right approach. We think it is the right approach. SegWit, as I'm sure you know, was a technical prerequisite for the Lightning Network. Lightning Network couldn't function with transaction malleability being in place still. And so, you know, and then 2018, the initial work and the launch happened, and it's been purposeful all along. A couple years later, or several years later in 2021, November, Taproot gets merged into Core. And so, you know, there has been progress made. It's just, you want to be very purposeful, careful, methodical. You know, if I were one of those crypto, you know, VCs, I would say, well, maybe too slow. Well, you know, when you're building for the ages, it's very important that every decision you contemplate as best you can the unintended consequences, because they always exist. We know that. And it's, that'll ultimately be an existential type question. That's why very, very smart people kind of spin. We all work for Bitcoin at the end of the day, right? And I think people that are focused on Core, they've made it their entire mind space to think about these kinds of changes. And that's the way that they're working for Bitcoin. And so, you know, where would we be without those kind of folks doing what it is that they do best in their area of expertise? And so, you know, progress has happened. And so if I want to put my, you know, at least try to empathize with some of those arguments that they might make, I would say, look, progress has happened. We've been very careful because we felt like it was always going to be Bitcoin. And that is the approach that ultimately the Bitcoin community has taken with Core, and I think will continue to be, which is great, because of all the risks over the next 5, 10, 25 years that entrepreneurs take when they build companies, if they're thinking about monetary adjacency or payments adjacency or whatever it might be, they're thinking about Bitcoin. We talk about it a lot. You're taking career risk necessarily to build a company. You have an opportunity cost at play. You know, if you're a domain expertise, a domain expert in some industry, you're going to be making at least a $500,000, maybe $1 million or more per year as a business leader in that industry. So, you know, what's the opportunity cost for building this company? It's got to be a big asymmetrical thing that you have high conviction on. Smart entrepreneurs, you know, the last additional risk that they would take given the opportunity is platform risk. Can you imagine thinking about building on Solana, a network that's got to be rebooted every couple of months? You know, you're given the opportunity when you have the light bulb moment that, oh, wow, I could do that on Bitcoin. Like, why would you do it anywhere else? And so, you know, we think that's going to be the driver for a lot of these people sort of, oh, gosh, wow, I can do this on Bitcoin. This is, I would have always wanted to do it on Bitcoin. And that latent demand is certainly there.
Right. Do you think then you mentioned this quote of you can't move fast and break things when you're playing with the internet's money. This is like a big deal. It's a foundational layer, and it's something we're not trying to break. Is that still true when you're talking about the Lightning Network? Do you think we'll have more companies taking bigger risks, trying to move faster? Are you seeing onto the second layer and maybe even layers above or layers beyond? Do you think we'll start to see more companies willing to take bigger risks, knowing that they're not maybe directly influencing the underlying Bitcoin protocol?
I think it's a great question. And in fact, my answer is, I think it's that way by design. You know, I think if you make a change to Bitcoin Core and it's a mistake, it just broke everybody's, there's not an opportunity for me to take a risk with Bitcoin Core that doesn't necessarily impact literally everybody else on Earth, potentially. And so with, you know, a Lightning channel, if I'm doing something a little esoteric, at least in that channel, that's kind of, it's limiting my risk to the consideration that's locked in that channel. And I certainly could do some other, a fifth or a sixth implementation of Lightning Network if I wanted to speak to the protocol. The risk is meant to sit in this layered approach. And so, definitely, I think that will be the case. I don't know if it'll be, companies, or if it'll be people building implementations, but, it's the higher up the stack you go, the more tightly bound and controlled the risk set is. And then, ultimately the market can make some decisions about what kind of risk appetite that they have, if they want to participate there and validate it or invalidate it because there's no demand. But the lower down the stack you are, the more risk is generalized to everyone else. And I think that was a key factor in, during the block size wars, leaning into a layered approach, as it sort of, kind of hermetically seals the risk from Core and puts it into a different layer in the overall stack.
Health insurance sucks. It's confusing, expensive, and frustrating, but there's a better way. CrowdHealth was created to get rid of the headaches of health insurance. You get access to a community of people who are willing to help out in the event of an emergency, as well as telemedicine visits and more, without doctors' networks getting in the way. Let CrowdHealth help with your healthcare needs. You can get started today for just $99 per month for the first 3 months if you use code Kevin to get the healthcare you deserve. Again, CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com. That's joincrowdhealth.com. Code Kevin. Now, I think there's a view that has been held for a long time among some in the ecosystem that because Bitcoin and Lightning, because these are open systems, it is going to be hard, maybe almost impossible, for some companies to capture, value, in the sense that, Google or Facebook or Amazon was able to capture a lot of value in their kind of walled garden. Are there any particular themes or use cases that you think lend themselves very well to capturing value? And this could be on Lightning or on Bitcoin. Any particular instances of companies where you're watching them and you're going, they look like they're about ready to capture value, build a profitable company, and succeed as a business. And on the flip side of that, are there any areas of the Lightning or Bitcoin ecosystem where you look and you say, I don't think anyone's going to be able to capture any value there?
Mm. I think it's interesting in the question, and I've talked about this with, some of our investors and, potential investors, and how we think about value capture. And one of the things that I find, this is a bit tangential or adjacent, but I think it's relevant here. The idea of value capture, that choice of language and the mimetic effect of using that framing, which I do, it's not a criticism. I use that framing myself. If you think about it in kind of a dispassionate sort of sense, it implies the ability to obtain control on a walled garden and that sort of thing. And so I think some of the real value creation will come from business models that we haven't yet thought of. One of the areas, or, it's really it's a hypothesis or a set of hypotheses that I think is very powerful, is value for value, in the sense that if you think about it, there are all of these marketing intermediaries that are, they're creating some value by creating a market where participants can go and then exchange, and they're taking a transactional piece in the middle. Understood business model, it's fine. But one of the things we've seen with some early examples in terms of, you know, very early adoption, is how value for value actually opens up entirely unknown ways, or there's not a pattern for things like, if you take Wavelake, for example. I don't know if you've had a chance to use Wavelake. There's a story, and I'll share just a quick version of it. A young artist named Ainsley Costello. She's 19 years old. She's based in Nashville. For about 5 years, she's been putting out music in different platforms, Spotify's and the like. She's had 25 songs that she's released on these platforms, 66 platforms, by the way, during that 5 year period. And in aggregate, after 5 years, she was able to make $750, which is, no one's able to live on this kind of money, obviously, but she's passionate about music. She's got some great tracks, by the way. Earlier this year, and this is very recent, this is this summer, a story that emerged this summer. She put three tracks on Wavelake, and in about 3 weeks, she was able to earn in sats about a USD $500 equivalent. For her, this was like, she didn't come from a place of, I know Bitcoin, I get Bitcoin, I want to try this thing. It just solved a very clear financial problem for her, where suddenly she can start to, annualize that and extrapolate how, okay, my passion, my music, my art here, I could actually do this in a financial way that is potentially self-sustaining. I can see how I can get some interesting distribution model. Now, these are people that had not run across her music before. I had no idea who Ainsley Costello was until I just kind of were an investor in Wavelake. So I got, kind of the inside baseball on how this developed very quickly for her. So she, this started happening really interesting, and right away, because of their kind of distribution model, which is ultimately meant to disrupt music publishing industry full stop, Adam Curry in his podcast was able to give a highlight or flag with a link that music being embedded and distributed through the plumbing on Wavelake suddenly meant that, like, hundreds of people, literally pages of pages on the back end in 63 sat increments were giving her a little boost. The ability to, like, express, like, if you think about it, I've been, like a thumbs up on Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn, it's really kind of fiat when you think about it. There's zero marginal cost. It's kind of a vanity metric. There's not any real true value expressed in that. So going from, zero value, real value, to any, it's a lot bigger than the numeric expression of whatever that unit of currency is. And so it opened up this opportunity for other people to just flag it. Suddenly they're getting distribution of her to an entirely new audience. Hundreds of people had an expression, and here's the clincher. Imagine you're a famous person, a celebrity of some sort, and a musician. There are weirdos in the world. The last thing you would ever want to do is open up the ability for direct communications. That would probably feel rightly very scary and that sort of thing. But suddenly you're able to comment and engage. You can send a boost directly to your artist. There's something almost, it's not really my thing mostly, but I find myself it's almost like dangerously addictive, sprinkling sats all over this platform. It's very fun. Back to the business model, and what I think is interesting is we really wouldn't have known what I think is we've seen from Noster and others, a zap, this value for value of expression, whether Noster goes on to, be the communications distribution platform for social and other use cases, you know, 20 years from now, I think it's an, you know, open question. But the way that adoption happens is we find some paradigm that gets very strongly validated, and then that becomes a design primitive that's used in other cases. And if there's one thing in value for value that's been very clearly validated in my mind, that's like the Zap or the Boost and Wavelake parlance, that to be able to give an expression of value, it's huge. It just feels special. It feels good. And that design primitive is going to go forth in perpetuity. I'm just pretty convinced of it at this point. It's been so highly validated. And what's great is if you're not a Bitcoiner, you've probably not run across it yet. So you can see how we can have in a value for value context, we'll have, you know, our Arab Spring moment, where that was an early adoption moment for Twitter. It found some validation in a way that was hard to stop communications when nation states were trying to. They got around it. That will happen for Bitcoin companies, but finding those primitives, seeing the design pattern, and then realizing, oh wow, I just communicated directly with this artist that I hadn't heard of. I was able to give them a little expression of gratitude. They're suddenly starting to make real money, or some money that they can plow back into making. And all the incentives suddenly line up. It's not music that is a formula that big music labels know that we'll just do this thing because this always works. It's low risk to try something, to publish on a platform. If it works and it catches on, there's some piece of that that allows you to see, okay, that's what the audience responded to. Let me do more of that. They're finding value. It's opening up the opportunity for innovation that just wasn't really possible. And so real value through Bitcoin in conjunction with, you know, novel business models, it really just creates the landscape that founders in conjunction with their customers on their platform can then go and experiment and explore. And so I think this happens over a significant period of time. Currently, we're so early. I think we're actually just in a really fun kind of phase. It really reminds me of the mid-90s when I was younger and, you know, people were trying all kinds of stuff. Most of it wasn't working. Occasionally something would work. And then, you know, the next, we went from Mosaic to Netscape and then, you know, and rock and roll from there. So anyway, it's an exciting time, I think, is the short way to say it. You can tell I'm getting animated.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. I've had some of these moments as well, watching value for value work through the podcast and then through myself sending sats elsewhere. It's been very cool to see. And I like that point you made about capturing value may be the wrong term here, because it implies there's like a garden or a wall that you're capturing someone in, kind of against their will, right? Yep. And we now have a system where you can express your value without anyone forcing you to do it. Mm-hmm. There's no requirement. You're not captured. You just get to choose to pay forward some of that value. And I think what people are going to find over time is that there's another hidden benefit here in making that transaction actually costly, is that it ends up feeling good when you do it. Like even giving money, you feel like you've actually done something for the person. Whereas,
and you have.
And when you do the like on someone's Facebook post or Instagram post, you don't feel like you've done something for them. I mean, there's another million people that liked the same post. It did nothing for them. Their bank account is still at the same level as it was before. They haven't gotten any new, you know, maybe at some point it can incrementally attract new sponsors or something, but there's no direct benefit for that person. Whereas here you have a real direct path to contributing to that person's work. So I think it's really cool.
I would just add one point there, comment. Of the things that I think is interesting, and it really has to do with, you know, this creative destruction process, this, you know, really this disruption and innovation, entrenched incumbents, the reason why it works the way it does is if they've got a big book of business, it's very risky to take a strategic direction that's higher risk and less well known. And that means that, you know, for example, if you're a large newspaper, you know, who wants to sign up for a monthly subscription and pay for a year to get the reduced cost? You're going to read, you end up a per articles read, it's very high. You know, you would like to pay for that one article, consume it, and that seems fair, but you're sort of like crowbarred into buying more, this bundling concept. It opens up a gap for other people that are a smaller business. It's less risky for them to say, you know what, we're going to give it away and see what gets validated and find the value that we can do more of and find an audience. It feels hugely scary and risky to say, you know what, we'll distribute it and let people's response be connected to how I monetize my own time and my creative production. And so that opens up the gap. That means that there's an opportunity for very young, very small companies to explore these things, because they're, you know, it would be a strategic mistake if you're on the board of a very large media company to decide we're going to completely change our model and just see if it works. You know, and so that's how the disruption actually, it makes no sense business-wise for them to do it, which creates the opportunity for these early companies. If your audience hasn't got a chance to try too much with some of this value for value stuff, it's just, there's something just immensely satisfying about it.
Yeah, it is really fun. Now I want to touch on one final piece to TVP's portfolio. You alluded to it earlier, and I've seen a few AI companies that you guys have funded. And so, by the way, this is like well before this AI boom of 2022 or 2023, where everyone got super excited about ChatGPT. You guys have been at this for a very long time. I want to understand, if AI is connected to Bitcoin in your view, do you think that these eventually cross over, maybe cross-pollinate, and there's use cases to plug Bitcoin into some of these AI companies? Or more broadly, what role might Bitcoin play in the AI ecosystem?
Yeah, love the question. We've been thinking about this for a long time. And in fact, our first fund, because there wasn't sufficient deal flow for a dedicated Bitcoin ecosystem mandate at the time, you know, going back to the 2015-2016 timeframe, the strategy that that I built for the first fund was to explore the intersection of, you know, Bitcoin technology, security and privacy, and applied AI. You know, they share some things in common computationally. They're all deep tech, and we've kind of seen, you know, the end game for a long time in terms of like the intersection. And I think, yes, AI is very important. And I think just a couple of market view pieces that kind of answer your question here. First, it doesn't make sense. It's actually, if you think about it, that some sort of artificial intelligence, can you imagine them needing to open up a commercial bank account and thinking about, you know, knowing that 90 milliseconds for a computer is an eternity, thinking about 90 days in clawback for using ACH rails to do whatever it is they need to do. One of the fundamental promises of AI is, and has been for a long time, is in due course, they'll be able to improve their own code, like, you know, self-healing. Part of that, in terms of things, simple things like training sets, training data, they might not have access to training data that the AI would recognize would actually increase their efficacy. And so to be able to identify a resource or resources that would improve their efficacy, they could identify those. They need to obtain them. These large training sets are not generally free. So if you think about an AI, maybe it's kind of funny to imagine them going to the store and making a purchase with a credit card. It really should, because I don't believe that an AI will use a credit-based money. It doesn't make any sense. They think in speeds that are incredibly fast. And so to be able to acquire a resource and then subsequently, you know, we think about, being humans, we tend to naturally think about, hey, AI impacts, improves, or maybe it adds risk to our life in some way. But many services will probably in the end be only machine to machine. And so there's a transaction piece there. You know, they have resources they need. They have to obtain those. They have resources or can be a service or a resource for other machines even in the end. And so those might be, if you think about it in an API call kind of context where you're making calls to machines and maybe you're doing many tens of millions over some time horizon to pay for a very, very small amount of money. It doesn't even work with legacy rails. It's not a choice that they would make. It seems to my mind less likely that they would open up trade credit with another machine or certainly a human that might not ever pay them. And so I think all roads point to Bitcoin and Lightning being the critical solve there. So there's that's logical. It makes logical sense to me. I think there's actually an important piece here that we're not putting enough emphasis on in the Bitcoin, you know, startup company industry currently. And that's all of the decisions that are made by AI in the future are based on present patterns that are being built. If you think about the future in hindsight, in a Bayesian kind of sense, you really want to build into those future models patterns, demonstrable results from patterns that we're using today. And I worry sometimes that we're not using Bitcoin, you know, layer one and Bitcoin Lightning payments and in an AI context to demonstrate how this can work for the future. That's actually probably an existential adoption risk that's, you know, maybe 10, 15 years away or so, that we need to be building that pattern more deeply into companies today and our use case. There's not, you know, there's so many startups currently that have gotten a lot of funding at ever higher valuations that are focused on AI. It would almost, you know, be that there's someone internal in those companies that's a, you know, a dyed-in-the-wool Bitcoiner that needs to champion this approach. That's not how payments work currently in AI. I think that's a long-term risk for Bitcoin, and we need to build that pattern so AI in the near term can start recognizing how things can work for them in the future. And then, you know, in some roundabout way, we're kind of creating the pattern to force long-term adoption on Bitcoin for us in the future. But it's ultimately between AI and humans, it's symbiotic. It just makes more sense for us to have a common, you know, and again, you know, all AI is internet native by design. It makes sense for them to be using the internet's native monetary layer as well.
I love that. Let's finish this off with a few rapid fire questions. You ready?
Sure, let's go.
All right. What is one book that has changed your view of the world?
I always feel risky with these like choose one kind of questions, which is the point, right? You know, I was thinking about this. I thought you might ask a question about a book. So I was thinking about this last night and kind of thinking about my life to the early years. And I think I had some what I thought were just kind of normal kid experiences, you know, education wise and things. And but I recognize now how uncommon it was. And so it's something to be really grateful for. When I was in, I think it was fifth grade, it might have been fourth grade, I read a book by someone named O.T. Nelson. It was called The Girl Who Owned a City. And, you know, in hindsight, for a pretty young guy, like it was actually a pretty like a cataclysm had happened. There had been a virus that killed all the adults, like above, like, I think, of the age of 12 or 13. And these kids in, like, you know, very dire circumstances had to understand how to work with others versus fight and, you know, and defend themselves, make sure they were secure. And so it's survival and thinking about, you know, dire circumstances and nevertheless seeing human potential in that, which ultimately is a very bright story, despite our kind of lesser tendencies to fight in war and these kinds of things. So that, I think that kind of framed me, that and a few others. There was another one that I still love. In fact, we kind of an interesting, if you ever come to Austin and visit the TBP office, just for our bookshelf, we thought it'd be fun to plant some Easter eggs around here and things that were formative for either me and Dustin. So we kind of made separate lists, and there's like some overlap too, you know, and there's a copy of The Girl Who Owned the City on the bookshelf, as well as the Tripod series by John Christopher. So anyway, you got two there.
Awesome. If you could only hold one asset for the next decade and it could not be Bitcoin, what asset would it be?
So if it can't be Bitcoin, that sounds like there must be sort of a crisis scenario, like there's not a power grid or there's not reliable internet available. So in a scenario like that, I think, you know, I want something that would produce cash flow and has, you know, a needed market for trade as well. So I think I would go for real property that produces something like that. I'd have like a business scale and secure olive orchard on it. You know, olive oil it's very energy dense. There's a high, you know, currency value per regular, you know, consumable unit. Also, it's, you know, very divisible. So it has some other properties of money. You could trade units down small enough to where you could trade for all kinds of things or even large quantities. It's transportable. So yeah. Business scale olive orchard, final answer.
Awesome. I think you've put an incredible amount of thought into this olive orchard. I love it.
Actually, that's probably a thing I'm going to really do. So
I love that. Who's one builder in the Bitcoin or Lightning ecosystem that you'd like to give a shout out to for doing great work?
There's a lot of them. There's a lot of like really special people. So it almost feels like showing favoritism. I would say I'm going to give a shout out to Graham Krizek because he's seems just like he's absolutely thriving despite the fact that he's a solo founder. He's doing some very big things with kind of behind the scenes, increasingly high profile brand names. He's, you know, he's married and has I think 4 children. You know, he's just doing it all and thriving. And by all accounts, you know, he's kind of an engineer's engineer. He's got high energy. He'll, you know, he's available and hustles for his customers and who are also builders in their own right. So yeah, Graham's fantastic. I'll give Graham a shout today.
Yeah, Graham's great. All right, before you go, where can listeners go to learn more about you and TVP?
Our website is a great starting point. We mentioned the research that's available for download for free there. It's TVP, Tango Victor Papa, .fund, Frank Uniform Nancy David. So short URL, easy to find on X, formerly noted as Twitter. I'm MECEE, and TVP is Trammell VC on X as well. And we make a point to be easily accessible. You can shoot me a message on Vita, straight to my mobile phone, LinkedIn, Telegram. Again, St. Paul, be all things to all people, right?
Awesome. So, thank you again for taking the time, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Love it. Thank you for having me, Kevin. Great to be here, and you have a good rest of your day.